From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Maryland is grappling with what to do about the surge in overdoses of prescription pain pills and heroin. Governor Hogan's Emergency Task Force has released its interim report. We touch base with Baltimore's health commissioner and a program coordinator on the Eastern Shore about how they're approaching the epidemic. Then we speak with David Simon, producer of HBO's famous depiction of Baltimore street life, The Wire, about Baltimore's crime surge and Simon's latest HBO miniseries about public housing. Plus, two student filmmakers tell us about their web show Marylandia, a spoof of the independent film channel hit Portlandia. It puts a comic edge on community issues like police brutality and transgender rights. And the environment in focus with Tom Pelton. First, news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Deaths from heroin and opioid overdoses have continued to climb this year in Maryland, as in many other states. Last week, Governor Hogan's office released an interim report from his Heroin and Opioid Emergency Task Force aimed at curbing addiction. The task force's recommendations range from police efforts to disrupt groups distributing drugs to improving treatment centers to media awareness campaigns. No part of the state seems immune from the overdose epidemic, so late yesterday we touched base with a coordinator for the Opioid Misuse Prevention Program on the Eastern Shore and with Dr. Lena Wen, Baltimore City's health commissioner. Since Mayor Rawlings-Blake's Heroin Treatment and Prevention Task Force made recommendations 6 weeks ago, I asked Dr. Wen if she's seeing results in the city.
You know, the issue with heroin and opioid abuse is something that the city has faced for decades, and we know that we need both short-term and long-term solutions. And so our long-term solutions include making sure that there's treatment on demand, that the moment that someone needs treatment for addiction services, that they can get it. But we also need to have other short-term wins as well, because we have to make sure that we're saving people in order for them to get treatment in the first place, which is why, while we're focusing on treatment on demand, we are also emphasizing the importance of preventing overdose deaths, because we have to save a life today in order to have a better future tomorrow. So it's hard for us to track results in a way that you mean immediately, because we know that we have to track both the number of people that we're training for overdoses to prevent overdoses, which is a number that definitely has increased. We're at more than 3,000 people trained in this year alone to prevent overdoses, and that's a 400% increase from last year. That's a number that we're very proud of, but we know that we have a long way to go, and also that we have to find the numbers next year for the number of people who are dying from overdose, as well as the treatment availability that we have in the city.
So 3,000 people, these are mostly police and first responders trained?
No. They are primarily family and friends and community members who are trained, and that is what we are particularly proud of. Yesterday, for International Overdose Awareness Day, we had outreach workers doing trainings at many sites across the city. And we had people coming from the streets who are saying they had members in their family who died from overdose. They did not have the tools or the time to do anything about it, and now they want to have the medication, naloxone, in order to save someone else's life. And yesterday alone, in one day, our outreach workers did 382 trainings, not of first responders, not of police, but of community members who now can save the life of a loved one or neighbor or someone that they encounter here in Baltimore City.
We've talked before about naloxone and the price of it that spiked earlier this year. Is it affordable? Does the city have enough naloxone for all these newly trained interveners to use?
This is a really good question, and we are targeting the naloxone pricing issue on several fronts. The first is that we continue to work closely with Congressman Elijah Cummings in raising awareness of why this generic medication has gone up in price so much, and he has asked for an investigation into this, which we very much believe is necessary. The second is we're fortunate to have received a donation yesterday. This was announced by Kaleo Pharmaceuticals of an injection medication, intramuscular injection medication called Evzio, which is also naloxone, but formulated like an EpiPen. And we received a donation of more than 6,500 of Evzio, which, again, is not a long-term solution, because long-term we need to find a sustainable way for our city to afford naloxone. But in the meantime, that is a potential of 6,500 lives that we can save. The third method is that Medicaid currently in Maryland covers naloxone, such that patients who have Medicaid will pay just $1 to get it. And so that's why we're encouraging for everyone to get prescriptions for naloxone so that they can get it filled for just $1.
Dr. Nguyen, I have read that nationally about maybe 1 out of 8 heroin addicts is able to overcome the addiction. What are you doing in Baltimore that raises those odds?
Let me take a step back and question those numbers for a moment, if you don't mind, which is that our numbers, based on national studies, show that just over 1 in 10 patients who have substance addiction are able to get the help that they need. So if you're not able to get the help that you need, how are you going to be able to tackle that particular problem? I mean, we would never say to somebody, well, I'm sorry that you have to be on dialysis, but we only 1 in 10 people get dialysis, and so you have to fight this yourself without the help of something that we actually know is going to save your life. We have to see addiction and mental health needs in the same way. And so here in Baltimore City, what we're doing is we're looking at what exactly is our treatment capacity. We need to understand exactly what our need is for inpatient services, outpatient services, mental health, for medication-assisted treatment, for detox services. We need to know exactly what those numbers are. Compare that to the number of people who need help. And that will allow us to then say, here's how much funding we need so that every individual who needs assistance can get it. We also have to have treatment on demand. We cannot let somebody wait 3 weeks, 3 months, in order to get the treatment that they require. No, we would never say to somebody, wait 3 months, and if you haven't died from a stroke, come back and we'll treat you for that stroke at that time. So that's what we're working on in Baltimore City, while we're looking to also overcome and reduce overdose deaths, that we're also looking to improve treatment and specifically expand treatment capacity. And these are all recommendations that are part of the Mayor's Heroin Task Force, which we are committed to implementing through leadership at the Health Department and through our partners across the city.
And we'll keep in touch with you about how that goes. Thank you so much for talking to us. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheila.
Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We also spoke with Beth Williams, who coordinates the I Wish I Knew campaign in Talbot County. It's part of the Opioid Misuse Prevention Program in 5 counties, Talbot, Kent, Queen Anne's, Caroline, and Dorchester. The campaign recently received federal funds for outreach. I asked Beth Williams about the connection between misusing prescription pain relievers and heroin overdoses.
It seems like, at least what we have found in Talbot County and in the Mid-Shore region, is that numerous people are starting out, 12 to 13% actually of our adolescents reported abusing prescription drugs in the last 30 days. And we're finding that it seems like many people are starting by getting prescribed medications out of a medicine cabinet of a friend or family member. In fact, almost half of those who end up injecting heroin started with using prescription painkillers.
And is it the overdoses that, I mean, those including those that turn out to be fatal, are they more after someone has switched to street drugs like heroin, or do they also come from prescription drug use?
Yes, certainly what we're seeing, you know, people can overdose on opioid drugs, but, you know, you have a specific dose to a medication. Even if somebody is misusing it, there's still a predictable dose in most cases. But when you get to heroin, that's what we're finding is most people are overdosing or coming very close to overdosing or close to dying on heroin that they're getting off of the street, which is, you know, not regulated. There's no dose. There's no, you know, safe measure of use at all of heroin.
The I Wish I Knew campaign, do I understand correctly? It is sort of, it is like the public outreach part of this opioid misuse prevention program.
Yes, that's correct, Sheila. It's a media campaign that we actually initiated at the beginning of our program. You know, usually media is incorporated as we go along, but we had the opportunity to introduce a campaign that would be, it's very innovative. It kind of is a conversation starter here on the shore. Our hope is that it would raise awareness, engage people, kind of maybe start to get people to accept that, yes, we do have a heroin problem on the Eastern Shore.
I'll tell you, some of the statements on your website that came from Twitter messages are just heartbreaking.
Yes.
I mean, these I Wish I Knew statements. One is, I wish I saw the signs that my son was on drugs and I was the number one enabler.
Yes.
Somebody else wrote, I just lost my daughter on Valentine's Day due to heroin. I really wish that there were houses that our children could live in while going through recovery. The process for our children getting clean needs to be longer than the 30 days they normally do. It stinks that no one seems to want to let us open a house just for this. And another one, there were no recovery houses in Talbot County for women. It makes me feel like help wasn't available for women with limited funds.
Right.
You said you wanted these messages to start a conversation. How long have you been publishing these messages, and is this conversation going in the Mid-Shore?
The conversation is going very well. We've had very good response, and as you read some of these statements, it is heart-wrenching, and every time we get one, we all, you know, reaffirm our dedication to this mission of prevention. Certainly there is such a need for treatment as well, and hopefully that will be an outgrowth of what we're trying to do. But yes, the conversation is, you know, really, really ramping up here. We feel that the media outlet, Soul Candy Media, that actually initiated the campaign, developed it, and implemented it, was just spot on with the message of I Wish I Knew. You know, it's a non-threatening message. It's informative, but it's also engaging at the same time. And we were really hoping to get people to feel comfortable to share their anonymous messages about what they wish they knew, either now or in their past. And it helps us kind of in our planning process, which we're starting to use all these messages and these, you know, this input from community to plan what we need to do to kind of address, you know, the gaps in information and the gaps in resources.
Beth, keep in touch with us as this unfolds.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate you talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
Beth Williams of the Opioid Misuse Prevention Program, which works in 5 counties on Maryland's Eastern Shore to prevent addiction. We have a link to the I Wish I Knew campaign and some of its messages, as well as more information, all at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Earlier, we spoke with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, David Simon on crime in Baltimore and segregation in public housing. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. For most of his career, David Simon has been digging into our most pressing urban issues: race, inequality, crime, policing. From his years as a Baltimore Sun reporter through The Wire and Tremé, his HBO series about New Orleans after Katrina, and now an HBO miniseries about a racial divide in housing called Show Me a Hero. It takes place in the 1980s in the working-class town of Yonkers, north of New York City. And David Simon is here in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's your thumbnail description of Show Me a Hero that listeners should know if they haven't seen it?
I think it's the place where the rubber hits the road with regard to race and our racial pathologies in this country. We spent a long time arguing about whether or not we're a post-racial society before the last year came up on us and made clear that we are not in any sense a post-racial society. And there are these friction points that still exist for Americans. And one of them is about sharing geographic space and sharing power. And at a certain point, when the majority, white America, the sort of normative America, the America that seems to work or be connected to the economic engines, when that's asked to risk anything, almost anything, all hell breaks loose. And it's happened. It happens around the country. It's happened here in Baltimore back in the aughts, a decade ago when they tried to do the Move to Opportunity in Baltimore County. And the same
from the Hud v. Thompson case.
When they were trying to move scattered site to Essex, take some low-income housing and scatter it around the eastern part of the county. You had the same political trauma. You have the same political trauma going on right now in Dallas. You have it going on right now two towns north of Yonkers, where Show Me a Hero is set, in Tarrytown. I mean, same county. Westchester County, New York, is still fighting the same fight, only two towns higher up on the river. We can't get past this. And this has been going on now for 30, 40 years after we've made the decision that, yes, everything we did in the previous half century was purposely to segregate the poor and segregate public housing by race. Willfully we did that as a plan. And so now anytime we try to remedy it in any sense, we go crazy. And that's what happened in Yonkers.
The title... Well, you took the title from the book on which this
Yes, year, Lisa Belkin's book.
A very carefully reported book. The title comes from the F. Scott Fitzgerald line, "Show me a hero and I'll write you a tragedy."
Mm-hmm.
So is there a hero in your story, or is it all tragedy?
They are, but they're all lowercase heroes in the sense of, and I'm not really particularly interested in uppercase heroes because I think a lot of our problems are systemic. And they're rooted in how we do business at this point, politically and socially and economically. And so I'm kind of down on the great man theory of history, that if we only elect the right guy or the pure of heart or the Lincoln-esque character, then we'll be fine. I think our political structures are now so compromised that I don't think the great man of history theory applies. Certainly didn't apply to Nick Wasisko. He came in...
Nick Wasisko was the mayor.
Yes, he was the mayor.
Who's at the center of the story you tell.
He came in, he got elected for running to the right of the incumbent mayor by saying...
On the public housing issue.
Right, by saying he would more aggressively pursue an appeal of the decision. When, in fact, everyone in the city government knew that the case was had been sort of rock solidly made by the U.S. attorneys and by the NAACP attorneys, and nonetheless, by offering the false hope of a more aggressive legal appeal, he won one election, and then almost before he was inaugurated, comes the phone call from the lawyer saying the circuit court, the appeals court, has refused to hear our appeal. It was a 3-judge panel; two of them were Reagan appointees, and we got to build the housing. And so then he had to turn around and tell the voters the truth. That he did tell the voters the truth and that he stuck by the truth even when it became incredibly hot and he became incredibly politically vulnerable for it was heroic, again, with a small h. I mean, he comes in with his flaws. He comes in with his false mandate. But when the world was watching, he did stand by the idea that the law is the law. And he stood alone for some of those hard votes on the council. And his story really was a political tragedy. Were some of the seeds of the tragedy of his own planting? Yes, I suppose they were. But there are other heroes in the piece. Some of the white residents who took the turn from being aggressively anti-housing to being good neighbors are depicted in Lisa's book, as well as people who never get any credit for being heroes, which are the government bureaucrats. If I say the word bureaucrat, a lot of your listeners are going to think, somebody just cakewalking on a public salary and not doing the absolute minimum. But actually, the people running the housing authority, the people whose job it was to make these scattered site townhouses work, to not have them become political footballs or become, you know, inner-city projects of the kind that the 50s, 60s, and 70s produced. They did a great job, and they were very conscientious about it, about their thinking, about their forward thinking about public housing and about how it could work and how they could avoid the mistakes of the past. So the heroes are in surprising places in the piece.
That's writer David Simon here on Maryland Morning, 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his most recent HBO miniseries, Show Me a Hero, written with former Baltimore Sun editor Bill Zorzi. Are there lessons to be learned from Yonkers 25 years ago?
The lessons to be learned are apparent. We just refuse to learn them. The heaviest part of this fight was over 200 units of low-income housing scattered about on multiple sites in a city of 200,000 people. And the city tore itself up, went to the point of bankruptcy, went to the point of sustaining unsustainable federal fines for refusing to cooperate with a court order in order not to build those houses. Yet when the houses were built, they're still there. Those townhouses are still occupied. They're still in decent shape. They never became a source of crime. They didn't impair the real estate market. Was there some white flight? Yes, there always is. If you read a book by Andrew Hacker called Two Nations, Hacker uses all the social science research to show that at about 8%, 9% minority presence in a neighborhood or in a school, you start to get white flight. There are some people that if they can't be in a hyper majority, they're going to run. And there's nothing you can do about that if you believe in the idea of an integrated society. So there was some white flight. It tended to be more about, not about the townhouses, but about another component of the case, which was school desegregation. And it happened in Yonkers, and it's happened elsewhere. We never come to the conclusion that the evidence warrants, which is that if we would accept a little or a moderate amount of desegregation, if we would risk a little bit of the societal welfare, so that the poor weren't hyper-segregated in these, you know, in places like the high-rises here in Baltimore, you know, that we used to have, or in the heart of East or West Baltimore. If we shared a little bit of our national dynamic, that people would have better outcomes. All people would have better outcomes, and that's actually been proven true. It was proven true in Yonkers. You know, we just don't learn. We want to fear the worst.
We just don't learn. You say we're not learning lessons. Is that going to change as the demographics of the country change, as it becomes a more brown country?
Well, some people are learning it, and certainly there are a lot of people in Yonkers who learned it the hard way. You know, Mary Dorman, one of the characters played by Catherine Keener beautifully in the miniseries, she began one of the most vocally aggressive opponents, and at the moment that she realized, oh, my God, they're going to build the houses anyway, and these people are going to be my neighbors, and I don't want my neighbors thinking ill of me, so I guess I got to go welcome them on some terms. I got to figure out how to help. And she became one of the strongest proponents because she found out that a lot of the people were seeking the exact same thing that she was seeking, which was a home and a neighborhood dynamic. And so all of her greatest fears never materialized. And she, you know, looking back over 20 years, I got to meet her before she passed away. Looking back over the 20 years after they built the housing, she was, to an extent, a little bit ashamed about how far they had gone in their reaction against it. I think that's exactly right. You know, a lot of people look at Yonkers and they say, oh, well, it was 80-20 white. Now it's 56-44. Look, you know, you're running the white. You know what? The New York metropolitan area as a whole is 40% people of color. The thing about integration is it's not there to keep places like Yonkers 80% white or to maintain a white hypermajority. It's there to help us orient ourselves to the fact, the real true fact, that we are going to become a more brown country. And we better deal with that in ways that don't destabilize neighborhoods and that lead to integrative logic. If we don't, it's just what we're saying is more white gated communities and more ghettos. And I don't know that that's the coarse and brutish country that we want. The inevitable future, the 21st century future is, yeah, every place is supposed to get more brown.
I can't let you get away without asking you about Baltimore right now, mm-hmm. 4 months after the riot on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. Where do you think things stand? And did you expect the crime surge that we've seen since then?
I've expected a crime surge for a few years now. I'm astonished by how suddenly it began and how distinctly it began after the riot. But actually, I'd written something two, three years ago about how the deterrent against violent crime had been eviscerated. Right now, the clearance rate for homicide which is mostly a black-on-black phenomenon in Baltimore, is like 35%. And that really means that by the time you shake it out in court, 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10 people are going to jail for taking a life in Baltimore. And if you leave people on the street who are violent, eventually the next year you're going to have a 5 to 10% increase, and the year after that you're going to have a 5 to 10%. So I was expecting, there was a moment in the administration of Mr. Bernstein, the previous state's attorney, where he went from charging 140 people a year for homicide down to about 70. And I wrote about that. And everyone sort of dismissed it as being, oh, well, he's not getting the quality of cases. And, you know, he's. But there was actually a change in dynamic where the state's attorney's office was less willing to risk anything but an easy case. And so they were putting people back on the street. The combination of the lack of deterrent plus this moment where the street cops stepped back, clearly they stepped back from the street as a means of protest over the indictments, I think it's led to this moment of realization on the part of a lot of people, a lot of the street culture, that there is no deterrent against violent crime. They're not locking anybody up when they kill somebody. And, you know, there are two things going on here now, one of which is the inner city, because the drug war has been over-policed brutally, and the poor have been over-policed by the drug war for the things that don't matter, for the things that shouldn't matter, for the things that we can't be jailing people for and ruining lives over, which is small-time drug stuff and street-level enforcement and failure to obey and loitering and all the things that were used by previous administrations to fill the city jail and to sweep the corners. That's led to an incredible alienation on the part of black community, and rightly so. They don't look upon the police as being the solution to anything because the police have been an army of occupation. And then the other thing is, when you really need the police to do what they can do well, if they're a functional police department, which is to police the real crime that makes a city neighborhood dangerous, which is to say murder and shooting, if you're black and you're in Baltimore and you're the victim of a violent crime, the chance of it being solved is minimal. And that's been documented not just here but around the country. Nobody cares. You know, nobody cares that the clearance rate in Compton or in Florence, California, or in West Baltimore or East Baltimore is 35%. I'm white. I live in Baltimore City. My chance of being the victim of a homicide is the same as if I lived in Omaha, Nebraska, statistically. But if I'm a young black male, if I'm a black male between the ages of 15 and 42, so I think it's the second leading cause of death. And yet, we don't have a societal deterrent. So where they need police, the police are ineffective. And where they don't need police, the police are brutally oppressive. When I was in the homicide unit in 1988, the clearance rate was 72% for all cases. You know, I'm telling you right now, it's 36%, 37%.
A lot to think about. Thank you.
Sure.
Very much. Writer and producer David Simon. His latest TV series, available on HBO, is Show Me a Hero, about a brutal fight over desegregating public housing. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also, more of this interview, some of Simon's thoughts about his audience. I'm Sheila Gast, ahead on Maryland Morning, Student Satirists, here on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Oregon has Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein of the IFC hit Portlandia, a series that spoofs the ways of that Pacific Northwest city.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local.
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local.
And now Maryland has Emily Eaglin and Ivan Figgs and their new show, Marylandia. They're two student filmmakers from UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, who won a Linehan Summer Research Grant to create the community-focused sketch comedy show Marylandia. The web series looks at social justice issues like police brutality and transgender rights with a comic edge in the vein of Key and Peele, Saturday Night Live, and of course, the series that inspired it, Portlandia. Both of the creators, both starting their third year at UMBC, are here with me in the studio. Emily Eaglin and Ivan Figgs, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You for having.
Tell me about the inspiration for the idea, how the shows like Portlandia influenced the style of your show.
I had the idea for Marylandia in my head ever since I was in high school, basically. And it was kind of like one of my big ideas that I never really thought could come to fruition until I was out of college or already in the field and all that kind of stuff. So we are both really huge fanatics of Key and Peele and Portlandia and shows like that. And we're also really big activists in the city. So we wanted to bring our two loves together. And thanks to the grants that you mentioned, we were able to do that this summer.
What is the big idea? You said it was one of your big ideas.
Yes.
What is it that you want to accomplish with this?
A sketch comedy show that is geared towards education and is geared towards giving back to the community. A portion of the grant money each episode goes towards community-related causes that the episode has to do with, and it's cited in the credits, so we want to also encourage other people to include the community in their art projects.
Yeah, I want to ask you more about that, but I'd like listeners to hear a bit of what you do. Your show tackles a lot of polarizing topics and issues of social justice like transgender rights. Here's a clip.
What you say?
You are so much prettier than me.
What we hear.
You're even prettier than me, and I'm a real woman.
That was from the third episode, which focused on gender identity. How do you choose the topics?
You know, we are both very passionate about, the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, rights for transgender people because, you know, communities that we, you know, love people in and have a lot of respect for. So things that are on people's minds right now, like because, I mean, with the whole Caitlyn Jenner thing, you had, you know, that sort of came into the limelight. So, you know, that was on people's minds. So we decided to do an episode that tackled that, although we actually had already been planning that before that happened.
But why try to approach it with comedy? Why not do a documentary?
We are all about representing the underrepresented. And a lot of the times when you tell it to people straight, if they don't agree with you, they might kind of just brush it off. And for me, when I am laughing along with a joke, especially if it's about a relevant topic such as gender rights or racial equality, if I find myself laughing about it, I know that I'm co-signing on to what it's saying and agreeing with it. And sometimes issues such as police brutality and protesting and, you know, transgender rights, they can be very exasperating. Like, the fight can be very exasperating, and it's really nice to take a step back from it and be able to laugh at, like, certain elements. Like, we don't make jokes about police brutality, but we do make sketches on the protests and, like, the volunteers, because that's us, you know. We're out there in Baltimore, and we're protesting just with everybody else.
So you're, in a way, you're mocking yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because we have this sketch now, that's what I call privilege, in which I play a very privileged white guy. You end up with the comedy, you end up reaching people you might not have reached otherwise. There are certain people, you know, who might never want to read an article like about white privilege because so many people think it's imaginary.
But they'll watch that Key and Peele
sketch. They'll watch.
Yeah, and for me, it's all about calling people out with respect and love. And I feel like there's a lot of love in my comedy. And when I, you know, make fun of a certain type of person, I present that person in a way where they are not to be hated. But it's kind of like, oh, that's like really ridiculous. But I see the flaw in what that person is doing in their actions. So my philosophy is like, let me be able to call you out. You can call me out just as much. And let's laugh about it, but let's never repeat those behaviors again because they can be hurtful.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Emily Eaglin and Ivan Figgs, UMBC undergraduates and creators of the web series Marylandia, a sketch comedy show with a community focus. You mentioned giving back part of the grant money. Tell me more about that.
Yes. So we are very selective in terms of selecting local causes to give money back to. When we did our Baltimore Uprising episode, we chose the Baltimore Education Scholarship Trust, which is a scholarship trust for young African-American students in the city to give that money to. And then the second episode, we donated to the Trans Lifeline, as well as a maternity wear that is for non-binary people in terms of gender. So it's called an alternity wear, and that is a local cause too, and they're called Butch Baby and Co. So we're really selective in giving back to the community. You know, there's a lot of really great stuff going on in the state and even Baltimore. I know you guys have covered the murals that are going on in Sandtown, and we see that stuff going on and we want to celebrate it, and we want to be very inclusive in the community, in what we do in art and film.
You mentioned, Emily, that you thought when you had this big idea that you'd wouldn't be able to do it, presumably for years.
Yeah.
What changed, other than the grant money?
Yeah.
Is that it?
It has to do with the grant money. It has to do with, I guess, some success that I garnered over a film I did last year called Future Children. And it kind of, the experience of being on the news and having the spotlight on me kind of got me in a place where I was like, okay, you know, people might want to hear what I have to say, even if I'm not this big name. So I was, you know, I was like, what do I have to lose going out for this grant? And I asked Ivan, and he was on board. You know, we're really just a team of two, but we have a lot of really great friends, and the community is so supportive. Everyone I've asked to be a part of the show has said yes without hesitation. And so it's just knowing that everyone here is there for us. And as I said earlier, I want to encourage other people that if you have that big idea, you know, don't let anything stop you from going for it now.
So you got a summer research grant, but we're heading into the fall. What happens to Marylandia after the summer?
We have, after the semester starts, I think 2 episodes planned.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I think it's sort of about if people want to see more of it.
Yeah, and sharing it. We really want to get the project out right now so that more people do see it and can get involved.
Well, good luck. Have a good time.
Thank you so much.
Emily Eaglin and Ivan Fix, student filmmakers from UMBC. Their sketch comedy series is called Marylandia. The first 4 episodes can be seen on the YouTube channel A Million Wishes. We have a link to it on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also a link to the Marylandia Facebook page. And our thanks to Scott Seiss for his work in producing this segment. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is September 3rd, the day in Maryland history in 1838 when a tall slave called Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey, who'd been working on the waterfront, disguised himself as a free black sailor and hopped a train heading north. His fake papers fooled the train's conductor, and after 24 hours and several heart-stopping alarms, he arrived in New York, then traveled on to Massachusetts. To better evade slave catchers, the fugitive changed his name to Frederick Douglass. We're back on Friday. Please join us.